This month marks another wartime anniversary, one that's not so well known. 100 years ago, a German chemist named Fritz Haber developed the first chemical weapon and convinced the German army to use it. His wife, Clara, who was also a chemist, was deeply opposed to the idea, and when she couldn't stop it, she committed suicide. Now that story, terrible as it is, was the inspiration for Judith Clare Mitchell's tender, tragic, and also very funny new novel, A Reunion of Ghosts. It's the story of three sisters and a suicide note that spans a century. And it all began with a PBS show.
I had walked into a room. My husband was watching this documentary, and I caught just a snippet of it. And they told the story you always hear about the Habers. He was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist who synthesized the first man-made fertilizer, very important because the world was on the brink of famine. And he took his fertilizer synthesis and tweaked it and came up with the first chlorine gases to be used in World War I. He was quite a fan of them.
Wow.
The German government did not want to use them, and he fought for them.
So this was the first chemical weapon.
The first chemical weapon. He's often called the father of chemical warfare.
So you walk into a room and you see a bit of a PBS documentary about these two chemists.
Yes.
What was it that fascinated you? Because you couldn't stop thinking about them.
I could not stop thinking about this. What interested me was the wife, Clara Haber, who knew what he was up to, was very opposed to it. They had horrible screaming fights about the use of chlorine gas, and she couldn't dissuade him from using it. Right about a week after he first deployed it, in the middle of the night, she went out to the family garden and killed herself.
Wow.
She was in her 40s. Her son was 12. He was the one who found her.
She had shot herself?
She had shot herself through the heart with her husband's service revolver, symbolically enough. And the idea of the 12-year-old finding his mother, and the next day Fritz Haber actually going to the Eastern Front to teach the generals there how to use the gas.
Even though his wife had just committed suicide?
Even though his wife, as far as I can tell, her body was still at home, and he left the 12-year-old to plan the funeral.
And didn't I remember that chlorine gas led one war later to Zyklon B, the gas that was
exactly
used in the concentration camps?
The chlorine gas was deliberate. He was trying to make that kind of a killing agent. The Zyklon was inadvertent. He was working on an insecticide for farmers. This was in 1933. Hitler came into power. He had to leave Germany, and the remnants, the non-Jewish remnants of his team, took the insecticide, which was called Zyklon, and all they did was remove the odor, and that became the second iteration, Zyklon B. So humans were not aware they were in its presence, and it was used as the killing agent in the concentration camps.
Another bizarre twist in this is the family was Jewish.
The family was Jewish, yes, yes. So their own relatives died from this agent. Now, I don't blame the family, but nonetheless, if you were a family member and made the connection, it would be very hard, I think.
It would be hard, and the novel you wound up writing, really central to it is the notion of a family curse.
Yes.
And the notion of the sins of the ancestors being visited on the descendants for generations, because this is what you're talking about, is
yes,
a sin large enough to weigh on multiple generations.
So huge, so all-encompassing. You know, I think of this book in a way as a biography of the 20th century. World War I is a war that it's the war that keeps on giving. There was the very imperfect peace project that led to all the subsequent wars.
Well, it led to World War II. The way Germany was shamed and humiliated and its economy destroyed set the stage for World War II. But more so, I think the wars we're fighting in the Middle East now.
Exactly.
We're beginning to look back to the way in the peace process after World War I, the Middle East was carved up.
We are still fighting that war. So much for the war to end imperialism. Southeast Asia, Ho Chi Minh, before he was called Ho Chi Minh, was at the Paris Peace Conference begging them to give Vietnam autonomy, and they would not do it. And we know where that led.
Well, let's talk about the book that you wound up writing, which is narrated by the three great-granddaughters
yes.
of two World War I chemists. T- take it from there. Tell us about these granddaughters.
So the great-granddaughters, their names are Lady, Delf, and V, which are nicknames. They are very bonded, fiercely attached to each other, very introverted. They have very dull, boring jobs, one of which is a job I myself had for 20 years. So I feel their pain, which is a paralegal.
Is that the paralegal?
Yes, a paralegal job working in wills, very deadly job. They have a wicked sense of humor that they share. They love puns. They love wordplay. But they also feel very much the weight of this family curse. Their mother killed herself. Their grandfather killed himself. Their great-grandparents killed themselves. And when this book begins, they have decided it is their time. So it's a book basically about suicide and fertilizer. I'm sure you want to run out and buy this book. But it's actually, believe it or not, funny.
Well, that's the thing about it. It's so funny that it is hard to put down. And this would be a great place to ask you to read a little bit from it, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, sure. We've been thinking about our eulogies lately, because this is not only our memoir. It's also our suicide note. We talked it over at dinner. We slept on it that night. The next morning, we made a pact. All for one and one for all. If one of us goes, all of us go. Everybody out of the pool. We have a joke. Well, maybe not a joke. A riddle. Question. How do three sisters write a single suicide note? Answer. The same way a porcupine makes love. Carefully. Also, tenderly and slowly, and by pressing on even when it hurts. We also have a chart. A week or so after our mother died, Delf, who was then 18, drew it up. She made it pretty and tacked it onto the back of her bedroom door, where some girls hang pictures of teen idols. And now there is a chart. It lists everybody who died and when they died and how old they were and where, and then it lists how they died. Suicide, morphine, suicide, gunshot, suicide, autodefenestration, suicide, cyanide, suicide, suffocation, suicide, drowning. We like the chart. It said that descendants of suicide view life as forever chaotic. But when we look at this chart, we see the opposite of chaos. We see order and routine. We see soothing predictability and reassuring inevitability. Without the rows and columns, all you'd have is a crazy game of Clue. Great Grandma Iris in the garden with a gun. Aunt Violet in the bedroom with a plastic bag. Mom in the river with rocks in her socks. But with the rows and columns, you have our family tree. Every family's got one. This one's ours.
The way you combine pain and humor is so distinctive. Is that was that a choice you made that you had to work at, or is that just your voice?
It's a choice I made to use my voice, I think is fair. I am a Jewish woman from New York City, and we're all Woody Allen there. We just, he's the one who got famous, but I'm telling you, we're all Woody Allen.
But you wrote a wonderful piece that I saw recently about humor as a weapon. So there's also a kind of political reading you can do of the use of humor in the face of, say, fanaticism or tragedy.
Yes. Dictators seem not to have a grand sense of humor, at least when it's directed to them. So in Nazi Germany, they literally had these courts that everybody called joke courts. And you could be hauled in if someone overheard you telling a joke against the regime.
Oh, no jokes about Hitler, huh?
No jokes about Hitler. Of course, there were a zillion that people would tell. But I love to picture this court, because apparently you'd be brought in there and you would have to tell your joke. And I'm trying to figure, if the judge laughed, did you get a worse sentence? It would be great in a Mel Brooks movie. It would really work. People told the jokes anyway. That's how important the humor was. That's what keeps you living, I think.
I read an interview you did recently with your former student, the novelist Chloe Benjamin, and she asked you what themes or questions you returned to over and over again. And you said, quote, death, death, genocide, death. Why?
If you belong to a group that was once a target of genocide, it's very hard to get that out of your mind. you know, I walk around thinking I'm just the most lovable person in the world. And it just, I find it staggering that anyone would want to pick on me that way. It's something very hard for me to forget about. And death also. I'm one of those people who think about it a lot. I can be anywhere and I will suddenly think, someday I'm going to die. And it's not morbid. It doesn't stop me from living my life or enjoying my life. And also as a novelist, I'd like to know the ending of my story. So maybe I think about, how's it going to end? You know, it does feel like a narrative to me. What happens next? What can I control? What can I control? And how will it all end? Maybe that's why I write books, to figure out how it will end for others. See if I can figure something out for me.
Judith Clare Mitchell's new novel is called A Reunion of Ghosts.